If I was in a prison in Mexico and I needed bailout money, I'd be calling him. It was a over $1 billion exit. I was never great at ever really taking feedback and being coachable. I really didn't have mentors. We threw all our chips in the middle of the table. We took all the founder risks that you would expect, and we went for a complete, unconditional, and unadulterated trust. We were 3 weeks away from a bankruptcy filing, some very difficult moments, some very contentious stuff. I thought we were done, and we got introduced to an Egyptian billionaire who ended up funding the project. The battles we were fighting were not as big or as crazy as what would happen in the next phase.
How would you have done it differently?
You should always have pure construct of other founders that are going through the journey in a similar way to you. It becomes a very powerful support network where you can call in those low periods. You become soldiers together and you end up vacationing together. So the easiest way to enter my world is that.
You're listening to The Helpful Podcast, the show that inspires high performers to keep on pursuing their passions. My name is Vahid Josey, and I'm sitting down with accomplished people asking who helped them in their tough times, the lessons they learned, and how they're making an impact. You'll hear authentic stories of vulnerability, of people giving when they have nothing to gain, and how you can unlock the community support you need. Before I tell you about our next guest, I want to thank you. I'm learning, I'm making mistakes, and I'm constantly improving. Thanks for being part of this journey. So, my next guest is special. He started a telecom company and sold it for over $1 billion. That company is called Freedom Mobile now. When he started, he didn't have any mentors. He wasn't even coachable. He was lucky, though, to find the right comrades. They went all in, they fought, and they won. You'll hear all the details. He doesn't hold back. Later, he did a 180 and founded an organization devoted to elevating the art of mentorship. Bryce Cheschuk is a role model to many. And here's his tale of human helpfulness.
Thanks for coming on the podcast, Bryce.
Thanks very much.
It's been a little bit since we last caught up, so glad that we got to chat beforehand. For those who don't know you, could you please introduce yourself?
Sure. So thanks very much, Vahid. Glad you're doing this. Good to reconnect. And here we go. Name is Bryce Cheschuk. By way of background, most known as a telecom entrepreneur. Myself and my business partners were the co-founders of a company called Wind Mobile here in Canada, which became Canada's fourth wireless company. It was a big scale up of the era from 2008 to our exit in 2015. We sold that business seven and a half odd years ago to a company called Shaw, which was one of Canada's largest cable companies. It was a over $1 billion exit. After sale, we took the proceeds of that and built an investment platform with a major skew to tech venture and innovation. We call that investment platform Global FCAP.
You're well known in the industry to be helpful. So that's how Gong's introduced you. That's how I've known you. And it's really fitting for the topic of the podcast. I would love to hear about a time where things were really tough and a lending hand showed up out of nowhere.
Yeah. So it's a great question. I'm going to phase this and take some time with the various directions that it's gone. It's probably not the direct drive of I had this one person that came magically who was senior and had all the wisdom and showed me the way. That's not how it went for me. And I think it's worth unpacking that a little bit.
Sure.
So when I was a youngster, I always like to start there, coming out of university and getting into the work world. This is in the mid 90s. And the first comment that I'll make about that era is that I would say that mentorship or that lending a helping hand was not as prevalent as it is today. In our startup ecosystem now, if I pick that as an ecosystem, even in corporate world, how wherever you want to go, the world of mentorship, sponsorship, pairing people up, having peers, young presidents organization, you pick your narrative, is everywhere. It's organized, it's structured, it's very accepted. The willingness to be mentored, the coachability, this is all a huge narrative. In the mid 90s, in my world, it wasn't a big narrative. Okay. I like to say to people, I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder. I wanted to build stuff. I was in a hurry. I was a very type A personality. And all of those attributes candidly didn't lend themselves well to even taking feedback, to being coached, and so on. And so what I found in the first era of my work world, which included some corporate and then some startup, is I really didn't have mentors in the classic sense that we know now. And as I've spent a lot of time advancing the craft of mentorship, and I've talked to a lot of people of my vintage, and I would say it was a pretty common refrain that mentorship was not actually that prominent back in that era. And I would say I fit that mold. So for me, how I would say I learned was predominantly in ways of what we would now call mentorship. Was really stealth mentorship, mentorship by osmosis, watching those who came before me who had the experiences, reading those kinds of things. But then a couple of things happened that enhanced support, we'll call it. And really for me, and I've talked about this publicly before, even for a guy who's super active, started a not-for-profit focused on mentorship and so on, when people ask me about this and I say I didn't really have mentors back in that era, what I do say is that's not completely true. I had peers and business partners that became super important as a support mechanism as we went through our journey. Okay. And I will be very prescriptive here because there aren't that many and they're important to the narrative. One of my current business partners is a gentleman named Dave Roth. I met him in 1995 in a corporate environment. We started our first company together in 1998. We went up, we went down, took a zero in .com one and continue to work together and do to this day. Dave has been, he's a personality that is different than mine, less aggressive, less extroverted, that kind of stuff. Is it almost a perfect foil to how I roll? Takes it from me and vice versa. And we've built this, what is that, 20, almost 25 year odd relationship, almost 30 year relationship working together. And so in the dark days, in a certain way, he's a guy I can talk to. We've gotten better at that over the years as one gets older and more mature and softens a little bit in terms of style. And we've lifted each other through this kind of relationship. And I view us working together till our end of days. So it's been super, it's been awesome. He's, again, he's complimentary to how I work and we've had a good run together. But probably where I could go into a little more detail, because that's just almost like the guy you call, if I was in a prison in Mexico and I needed bailout money, I'd be calling him, like that kind of relationship. In the telecom era, so I met my business partner, Tony Lacavera, 2003, literally through a recruiter. So he was looking for senior finance expertise. I get introduced to him. I meet him. I like him. I was looking for a move after dot-com one crash. There was this period where I had to go back to the corporate environment just to pay bills and kind of restabilize. And then in 03, I got the recruiter call saying there's this great entrepreneur. You should meet him. And I was really looking to get back into that world. So I met him, we clicked, and we started working together. And I started in a finance capacity with an opportunity to earn into a partnership, which I did over a few years. And we just worked together, got to know each other, got to like each other, and became friends as well as business partners. And that started the relationship. In there, another gentleman came into the mix, a guy named Simon Lockie, continues to work with us. So we're all about 20 years together now in that set of relationships. Again, we've gone through enough to know that if it was going to break down, it would have broken down by now. And we've gotten past those, we've crossed those chasms. And so take that as a starting point. We're going through, we do our first level of work together, which is pre-wireless. We're building a sequence of what I'll call alternative smaller telcos. We're buying companies. We're making mistakes together. We're learning. We're trying to scale. We're making cultural mistakes, but we're learning, doing all the things that you do. And over that period, very supportive group, the three of us. I would suggest that the battles we were fighting were not as big or as crazy as what would happen in the next phase, but we were building a foundation of how we work together and how understanding each other's personalities and building trust, maybe is a good way to say it, right? Which is super important to these relationships working. It's sort of complete, unconditional, and unadulterated trust. I've learned in the mentor work that I've done that we have these 15 principles of mentorship. One of the principles, we call it the human principle, is around building a foundation of trust with each side. And without that, you have no relationship. So we did that in our own way as founders together, if you will, partners together. We then start the wireless company, 2008, the most rewarding, but also the hardest project. And we threw all our chips in the middle of the table. We took all of the founder risks that you would expect. And we went for it. And we went for it in a way where it wasn't building a niche piece of software that was targeting a certain vertical. No, this is taking on Canada's wireless oligopoly, one of the most profitable, most pernicious, ugliest to fight against oligopolies. And so that just inherently creates a set of stressors as you're building. They're fighting you every day. They're fighting you with a very extended playbook. They're masters of managing government, the law, the court systems, all these kinds of things, GR. And we're inexperienced at that. We got headwinds continuously. There were a bunch of policy issues that we had. It was extraordinarily difficult. It was almost born in fire to a degree. I'll tell you a couple of stories. We almost didn't do the project because we needed a significant amount of capital. And we were out networking in 2008, credit crisis. I'm just trying to remember this chronology. Yeah, 2008, we wrote the business plan. We used our network, went around the world, and went as hard as we could to try to find capital. And we needed hundreds of millions of dollars to make a deposit to buy Spectrum. 10 days before the deposit deadline, we did not yet have the capital raised. I thought we were done, personally. Tony, ever the optimist and has good tenacity, we got a break in our networking and we got introduced to an Egyptian billionaire named Maguib Sawiris, who ended up funding the project. What was interesting about that is, so you've got kind of Tony Simon Bryce hunting around, doing our best, presenting our business plans, doing all that kind of behavior. And we meet this guy and he's multi-billionaire. He's got wireless operations in probably about 10 countries, big risk tolerance, and a structure, a corporate structure on how to do things. And it was at a scale that we had never encountered before because we were quite small. So we meet him and we were under such a tight deadline that he sends probably 15 guys to Canada to basically do this quick negotiation with us and him to get something paper to be able to put this money with the government and enter this auction.
To meet the deadline.
To meet the deadline. That first phase was, I would say, what caused Tony Simon and I to start working together in a way we hadn't exactly before, where it was pretty much 24/7 negotiation and battle with a group that were very sophisticated, had done this for a living, and there were a lot of them, with a lot of lawyers and a lot of certain style. And plus cultural differences, Canadians, Egyptians, different kind of, all of that kind of thing. So we had a lot of different factors that came at us fast. And we started to establish this cadence of how we would work together in a certain way, how an issue would be addressed by the three of us, how we could criticize each other, but also lift each other up when things were difficult. And it was an early taste of how to have this, almost this peer support thing that would go on. We got through that. We entered the auction. We bought the Spectrum. We started the company. And then a sequence of events happened that would require us to almost reconvene the threesome at certain moments where it was either existential to the risk or it just required some very, very collaborative thinking. Okay. And to give a couple of examples. So even though we had negotiated the deal to enter the auction, once we came out of it, with this, we then had to negotiate a far more sophisticated and elaborate set of shareholder and corporate arrangements. That was a very difficult negotiation, again, with our Egyptian partners. That caused us to come together, some very difficult moments, some very contentious stuff. We then get questioned by Ottawa around our ownership structure. So then we have to go to Ottawa and do another renegotiation of all our arrangements. And all of that is happening in a pretty tense environment with one hand tied behind certain people's backs because of the way the regulatory environment worked and a lot of navigation maneuvering, a lot of angst. We got through that. Okay. We start working on the project. 2011, the whole project's a struggle. The amount of money it took to get to the business plan was always more. The growth was always a little slower. It was all the classic startup stuff, but done at scale. Mm-hmm. And differently than some of the stuff the Egyptian guy had done, this was always a little behind where its plan was. Okay. And we threw a lot at it, but it was always behind. So it was always in the difficult box in his world. Mm-hmm. In 2011, he sold his interest in our company and a bunch of others to a Russian oligarch named Mikhail Friedman. Very tricky little maneuvering that happened there where we found ourselves with a new shareholder. That shareholder, there was a regulatory change in Canada, not to get too detailed, that allowed foreigners to take control of Canadian wireless assets if they had less than 10% market share, which was us. Our partner came to us and said, we'd like to buy you out. We had this back and forth negotiation. It went for 9 months. I remember Tony Simon and I coming together again in a very difficult and complicated negotiation with now a different culture, different head office environment, a different group of people that had arisen by virtue of the sale to this shareholder. And it literally took 9 months. It was culturally like something I've never gone through before. It was super enlightening and interesting. And again, I don't know if I remember it perfectly correctly, but I recall over 9 months, including weekends, typically 3 1-hour meetings a day with Tony Simon and I. This was our lives. Wow. This was our equity. This was everything to us. And we needed to get this right in a very complicated policy and other operating environment. So that period, I recall being extraordinarily difficult. And I recall the waxing and waning of each of us in our moods, in our styles, and some very, very, sometimes very negative to each other and so on. But we built a mechanism of support to get our way through. And we did. And we signed an agreement to sell our interest in Wind. And then a very funny thing happened. The Russian shareholders went to the government to apply for approval of the change of control, and they were disallowed. So wow. We ended up under a whole other story I won't bore you with. We ended up, all of that work that we had done ended up blowing up in a puff of smoke. And so that caused a whole bunch of problems internally, again, with their desire to fund and so on. And well, pretty well known in the ecosystem, but in 2014, we had a debt default and the shareholder said, we will give you one last treasury draw and then we're out. You guys, here's the keys. You guys figure this out. So the summer of 2014 became another almost existential moment for the company, for Simon, Tony, and I working together to deal with our side of it and also to try to recapitalize the business. Very difficult time. So we spent another, again, it's almost like you reconvene the war council and you do this again month after month. And again, working together like we never had before, each time almost getting worse because of existential risk. And then in August of 2014, in a very unhappy scenario, we ended up signing exclusivity with a potential recapitalization partner, who I wouldn't really call a partner. They were going to take the business. And I actually thought that we might be done. Like we were going to get a payout. It wasn't great. And it was over. It was a short exclusivity period. And as it was getting near the end of it, it became clear to us that this party was not going to actually exercise their right to do purchase. And so that caused us to remobilize again, form a consortia that was out there but had gone dormant, bring them back, recapitalize the company, and then move on to the next phase. And that sequence of events from a debt default, I'm trying to remember my timing, either February or April of 2014, through to the recap, which was in September of 2014. What I would say is it was a period where you were under distress with the company because we knew that we were going to hit a funding wall. I actually have told people this before. We were 3 weeks away from a bankruptcy filing. So in one room, we had a bankruptcy monitor getting ready to file, a receiver. In the other room, we had a bid room for people to come in and assess the company potentially for a recap. And we were doing that, trying to keep the culture intact and trying to manage this very difficult situation. And the helpful, back to your name of your podcast, was how did peers come together to both navigate a very delicate and difficult situation, and how did we work to lift each other up through this very difficult time? And what I would say to you is I had no knowledge of the best practices of what you would do now in peer mentorship, not creating an environment of psychological safety, not smashing guys when they're right at their lows and all this kind of stuff. We didn't know those practices. Tony had a bit of experience with YPO, but it was ancillary. And somehow in our way, in a fumbly environment, after all those other battles and building almost implicit rules of engagement of how to work together, how to work our way through these situations, we came to a way of working that allowed us to basically help that person who was in the worst point in each of those interactions, bring them forward and move this thing in a rational way. That's how it went for us. And so after that, we got through it. We ended up having a positive experience after that recap. We sold the business and then we moved on to the next phase of life. I'll say to you, we've never had to revisit that crazy style. We've gotten somewhat toward it in some deals that we've worked on that have gotten difficult, where we almost tried, as you may know, to buy our asset back from Shaw. That was an interesting process that kind of brought us back together in a similar style. But in general, where I found the best example of what your question asks is around peer support system to deal with the most difficult existential risks in our history. And when I look back after really focusing on mentorship and the craft and getting better at it, I say to all founders, you should always have a peer mentor network. And ours was within our business. And yes, you and your co-founders should figure out the best ways to work together, take things out of the workplace that could taint your culture. There's a bunch of best practices there. That's important. But you should also create a peer construct of other founders that are going through the journey in a similar way to you, not competitors, but like kind of peers at the stage and so on. And you guys should plan time together to deal with the problem that you're all having, be it talent, be it fundraising, whatever it is, in a safe space once a month. And the ones who've done this successfully, first of all, comes a very powerful support network where you can call in those low periods. But two is you become soldiers together and you end up vacationing together and it becomes, and I've had a variety of people in our ecosystem tell me that they came together in a way through a peer organization. Ben Baldwin had one or a few others, and they're still together a decade later. And it's, that is super. Tony's been a YPO guy for over 20 years. And some of those peer supports, they're personal, deep relationships that become super powerful. So that's my story on the matter is how I would say it.
The way help found its way to you was through the group that you were operating the business with.
Yes.
And through, I'm assuming, half dozen to dozen times of existential crises.
Yes.
You guys still pulled through.
Yeah. It's that scenario where you got to be careful using a wartime analogy. Going to battle in a war is different, obviously. But let's call it the light corporate version there, obviously, where you're faced with risks that for your circumstances are existential. And that stressor that takes you down and then you recover from going through that with a group of people, having done that, it changes your relationship and how you work together, how you build that foundation of trust with each other and so on in a special, important way. And that's how it went for me.
Really?
And maybe what I would also say is that I don't know if I didn't have that, what I would have done. Would I have sought out someone else to be a running mentor for me over those eras? I don't know. I was never great in that phase at ever really taking feedback and being coachable. It's never been a strong suit to mine until recent era when I've softened up. So I don't really know what I would have done, but that was the thing that we need, or I needed anyway, to get through that.
So with the version of you that is now,
yeah,
how would you have done it differently? You've unlearned and relearned a bunch of things.
Yeah.
In those scenarios, what would you have done?
Yeah. So I think if I use Tony as my example, I watched him going through that phase, working with Simon and I, of course, but also having the YPO structure. Okay. So he, in some of our darkest days, I don't know all the details, but he would have taken these scenarios. He would have called for a forum meeting. Mm-hmm. He would have taken it into his 7 or 8 odd peers. And that would have been very helpful. And then he would have had a lot of it, I think, one-on-one with them as they knew the story in a confidential way and so on. So he had external mentorship that were out of the business, but all had great experience, right? They weren't in our business. They were in their businesses and they had great experience. I would look to something more like that. Okay. I would like to follow some of my own recent cooking, build my personal board of directors, have my 3 or 4 people that I could call upon reciprocally for them to call upon me as well, that would allow me to even get out of just my Tony Simon Bryce triangle to give me that external support in a smart way. And I have become that for a lot of people in recent era, particularly founders that we invest in. And I see the value of it on the other side of the table. And I use this example a lot, about 100 portfolio companies. When the pandemic hit, one of our founders, her revenue went to 0 in a week. Okay, it was a transactional business. And what she worked, her domain basically went to 0 in lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
And she called me, and we start a rebuild process together. And I remember going to her office and all was locked down. We snuck in, her and a couple of her team, and we did the whiteboarding and the diagramming around the flywheel, all this kind of stuff. But most importantly is we're there for each other and you're not doing it alone. There are ways of walking one's way through this, navigating things with the next best, having other people to bounce decision-making off of, checking oneself and so on. And she made it through and ended up having a very good outcome because of her own ability and so on. But also, I think partly because of support around that gets you through those darkest days. And that's what I would be looking for differently now.
What kind of help are you always willing to get?
On my side, okay, it's actually a great question. I talk about this quite a bit in the ecosystem, but in 2018, after we'd sold everything, after you get a little bit of time to reflect back on it, and also entering our ecosystem as an investor and as a mentor through a lot of accelerators, I had this moment where I was at a lab in Toronto called Creative Destruction Lab. You'll know it well, many will who listen to this. And I was doing mentorship for my first time in person in one of their rooms. And I realized at the end of that, watching about 50 other mentors in action, that I'd been mentoring wrong my entire life. And so that was a big moment for me. And it caused me to, first of all, self-direct to try to figure out how to get better as a mentor. And then when lockdown happened, I ended up interviewing 150 people on the topic with a research assistant to get best practices. And we wrote a manuscript and we created an offer profit. So we went really hard on this concept. So what I would say to the group listening is the first order of business is I actually have an organization focused on mentorship. It's called Mindframe Connect. It's at mindframeconnect.com. Okay. If you go there, you will have a bunch of resources around how to be a more effective mentor, around how to be a more effective mentee, and around building the skills for entrepreneurial resilience. We go on these three tracks. So the easiest way to enter my world is that. Go to a website and start looking around if you're interested in the topic. And then I am very active in mentorship in our ecosystem, generally through accelerators and through the portfolio companies that we've invested in. And then third is if you have an issue that you'd like to talk about, I'm busy. Time is tight, always. The best way to get to me, and I'm always happy to take an hour discussion around an issue if I can fit that into the schedule, is generally through someone that knows me already. So a warm connection is always the best. And if that doesn't exist, send me a thoughtful LinkedIn message that explains context, gives me some rationale as to why, how you heard about me or know about me, and then we can figure out how to take it from there. I've mentored, I do think it's north of 1,000 people, and I will, at any given time, I have 10 to 20 of these relationships in varying stages. They can range from one-hour discussion to just kick around some ideas all the way to multi-year, depending on the situation.
As one of the most helpful people that I know, really.
Thank you.
I really love that you came on the podcast and shared your story. There are definitely bits and pieces that I didn't know. So Bryce, thank you. Really appreciate having you. And hope to see you soon.
Awesome. Thanks, mate. Appreciate Cheers. It all.
So what did you think of the episode? Hit me up with any feedback you have. Is there anybody you're curious to know who helped? Nominate them. I'll reach out and I'll get them on the podcast. You can contact me at hi@vahidjozi.com. That's H-I as in hi @vahidjozi.com. Chat soon.